It's the 1st of May, 2026, so I'll ask to say a few words, and this evening just a few things that are coming up, and I do want to apologize for whatever part I had to play in people getting poison oak right now. Sorry if I made you go up there and dive into the poison oak, and now you have a bad case of it, so I forget because I don't get poison oak, so I forget that. But then there are times when people who should get it don't get it. So hoping everybody would be somehow magically protected, but not everybody was. I remember going in 2019 on Tudong with Ajahn Saik and Tantissero, and we walked through the south end of the Lost Coast Trail for 4 days as part of our Tudong. And there was parts of the trail which had poison oak, which was way over our heads, that we were just having to go through. And amazingly, nobody got it. So I guess it's just hit or miss with the poison oak, whether you get it or not. We learn about living in nature. It can be quite enjoyable. We learn which plants to avoid, and there's actually in the Vinaya for wilderness bhikkhus, they need to know about which trees are good to sit under and which directions to sit. Basic knowledge is how to make a fire, how to read the stars, how to be able to tell the Upozita without a calendar, how to look at the moon and know what the phase of the moon is, and just have that basic knowledge of living outside. So these wilderness protocols, they're actually in the Vinaya. So, and they are very, very practical. You think about even the Buddha, the account of his awakening, he sat on the east side of the Bodhi tree facing east. So if you think about sitting on the east side of a tree facing east, especially in a tropical country, if you're somebody like the Buddha or an ascetic of that time, then you would probably just be sitting all day long and all night, or doing sitting and walking all day and all night, and just completely committed to that, absolutely, completely committed to purity of mind, nothing else, absolutely committed to the meditation. But then the subtleties of living outside become much more apparent, or one needs to know, one needs to have knowledge of living outside. So the sitting at the east side of a tree, of a Bodhi tree facing east. And if you think about that, then at the dawn time, then the sun would hit you. At the dawn time, the sun would hit you and you'd be able to warm up a bit in the morning. And then as the sun moved through the sky, then at the hotter part of the day, you would be in the shade and you'd be more fully shaded at the end of the day as the sun sets in the west. So sitting on the east side of a tree facing east really makes sense to see some of the practicalities of living outside that the ascetic Gotama, before he was the Buddha, that he would have learned about, that he would have known about. And then Bodhi trees themselves, like we've got this nice Bodhi tree that is loving being next to that giant window. And so Bodhi trees also are interesting in that they don't drop much sap, if any, so they're quite pleasant to sit under. The leaves are big, so they have good shade. And also the leaves, I've heard that the leaves actually emit quite a bit of oxygen, perhaps more than other trees, so they're, you could say that they would be refreshing also to sit under. That's what I've heard anyway. And also there is not that many fruits. There are certain seasons where Bodhi trees have these little fig fruits. So, for example, going to Bodh Gaya and doing long sitting under the Bodhi tree, you know, that certain seasons the pigeons come and gorge themselves on these fig fruits. And you have to cover yourself because the pigeons are dropping their droppings on your head, and you keep the wet wipes with you and wipe it off, keep sitting, and they're gorging themselves to the point where they're also vomiting on you. So certain times of year when it's not as pleasant, perhaps, to sit under a Bodhi tree, but for most of the year, then they have large leaves providing good shade. They emit a lot of oxygen, refreshing, and they have a wide canopy as well, and they don't drop much, if any, sap. So just knowing which trees are good to sit under, and sometimes it's nicer to just sit out in the open, not under a tree. That's one of the Dutanga practices. There's 13 austere practices that the Buddha allows in order for people to sharpen their practice or become more dedicated and develop more perseverance in their practice. One of them is living at the foot of a tree, and then another one is living out in the open completely. So you can't really keep all 13 at the same time because some of them actually cancel the other ones out. So if you're living out in the open, you're obviously not living at the foot of a tree. There might be times when you are living out in the open. There were practitioners in Tibet, for example, living in the mountains, and they would live out in the open. And so that's even more just living under the stars. I don't remember the first Tudong I ever went on. It was after my third Vasa, and I was spending 1 year in Thailand, and I had the opportunity to, was invited by Ajahn Siripanyo to do a 1 week Tudong behind Phujom Gom in this national park, Dongna Tam, in a really kind of austere forest, a lot of rocks, a lot of caves, a lot of mushroom-like rock formations. And sometimes at night, you just be on these cliffs above the Mekong River between Thailand and near Laos. You're looking out over Laos, so on the easternmost part of Thailand, and sleeping out on the rocks, very few insects. Maybe you didn't even need the mosquito net sometimes. So the monks use these called glot. In Thai, they say glot prat. So the umbrella tent with the mosquito net coming off the side that you can use for sitting and lying down under, sometimes not even needing that. And I remember there was one evening where I was just completely psyched on being on Tudong, and I was so happy to have that opportunity. And just everybody, there was maybe six or seven of us in total, and just laying out on the rocks and looking up at the stars, and just everybody was just laying there on the rocks, and we were talking a little bit and looking up at the stars. And those types of experiences are, I feel, quite precious to be able to have experiences like that. And I remember another one, it was fast forwarding again to 2019 with Chan Sek and Chan Tisaro, and it was in the Avenue of the Giants. There's actually a little beach on the banks of the Eel River that I've camped at a few times, and it's a really nice spot. And so we were there, and it's a secret little spot, so there was nobody around. And it was actually the Opposita day, just like today. It was the Padimokkha day, but there was just three of us, so we don't do a full Padimokkha recitation. We just do what's called Parisuddhi, where we do a confession of any offenses we might have, 227 rules of the Vinaya, and then we do a short chant. It takes about 5 or 10 minutes. It's a much truncated ceremony. And then we sat for a bit. So we had, that evening, it was just really cool, not much wind, stars were out, sitting comfortably on some sand, kind of a little bit away from the river, just very, very quiet, kind of like the outside is now, just the crickets going. And we had made a fire, so the fire was dying out as we were meditating, and just kind of the quiet crackling of the fire. And those types of things can bring a sense of peace and joy to the mind, to the heart. It's like these precious opportunities to live in the way that we do. We can think of experiences like this, and those can help us in our meditation. We can recall those types of things and bring some gladness to the heart. There's also times that are going to be more difficult, living in the monastery. And I could tell many, many stories about being in Anagarika in the beginnings of Abhayagiri, in year 5 of Abhayagiri, when it was much simpler, and sometimes you could say the kitchen was more fun sometimes, the type of fun where you don't really know what you're going to do, how you're going to make the meal, what's going to happen. And especially with our little kitchen, which was, you could probably fit 3 people, maybe 4 people would be kind of touching shoulders if you tried to fit 4 people in that original kitchen. And there was one little 4-burner stove, had a little oven, a little tiny sink, and Katina, we would have maybe 50 to 70 people. So to service a Katina with a little kitchen like that was quite a feat. Now we're much more equipped for that type of thing. And I would do a lot of dishes, and normal on the kind of normal days, I wasn't very good at asking for help. So people would disappear and then I would be there doing dishes for a long time, usually till about 1 p.m. And Debbie would come in sometimes and she would say, "Hey, they abandoned you again." And then she would come help me do dishes. So that's my memories of Debbie in the early days. And, but I remember Katina, and I was doing dishes and there was just more and more dishes coming. And I just made this determination. I made an aditana. I said, "I'm just going to do dishes until there's no more dishes." And so I was doing dishes all day. And I did dishes from after the meal. And all afternoon I was doing dishes because there was allowables. I think part of it I was making allowables. Maybe I took a short break to make allowables. But because the monks were sewing, then there was kind of more dishes trickling back in. And I was doing dishes until, it was like, it was dark outside and I was still doing dishes. I just thought, I'm just going to do dishes forever. But I kind of got into this flow of just doing dishes, just surrendering to it. And I think of that, that's quite a good memory. Yeah, and there's times that test us as well. We don't feel like we have enough time to meditate. Feel like maybe there's too much work in the monastery. And as a junior monk, I became quite critical of how much work there was in the monastery. I felt that because I'd read things like Patipada, the way of practice of Ajahn Mun, and also the biography of Ajahn Mun and different teachings of Krupa Ajahns in Thailand, and thought we should only be meditating. We shouldn't be doing anything else. That this idealized, this romantic view of practice. And kind of when I was an anagarik and a novice, I had the generosity thing going. But then as a junior monk, I developed these views that we should only be meditating. We shouldn't be doing anything else. And I didn't have the sense of respect toward really senior monks that I have now, that's ingrained in me now from living in Thailand and living this life for so long. So I angrily and upsettedly told Longpo Pasano that. It's like a labor camp here. What are we doing? And that didn't go so well. And that was one of the times where he actually helped me to see the anger that I was experiencing. And I didn't see it as anger at the time because I was still in this mode of everything was idealized. And the mind, you could say the mind was still really enmeshed in the worldly way of thinking. I thought it was Dhamma, but it was actually the worldly way of thinking because I was just being critical and judgmental and angry. And then the mind was just going along with that. It wasn't reflecting on what it actually was, what was actually happening. So with things like that, it's this reflection that there's the way of the world and there's the way of Dhamma. And these two things are really different. It's like you're either looking at the top of the hand or you're looking at the palm of your hand. You're not looking at both at the same time. Your hand is either, there's the palm or the top of it. You flip it over, it's one or the other. And so when the heart is enmeshed in the world, what happens is we have one of two reactions to our experiences. And we either have attraction or aversion. Or you could say we have three. We also have delusion. But but mostly it's easier to kind of think of it as two, as attraction and aversion. So when, or you could think of it like and dislike. And this is what in Thailand you'll hear the Ajahns talk a lot about itarom and anitarom. So that's in Pali we say itaramana and anitaramana. Itaramana is that which is wanted, that which is liked. Anitaramana is that which is disliked, that which is not wanted. And so what is wanted is something nice happens to us, something pleasurable, somebody praises us, or we gain some sort of status, or we experience some sort of gain, or we experience some sort of pleasure. This is like the positive side of the worldly winds. And we like it. We like it. We want more of it. And so the mind that is the heart that's enmeshed in the world will automatically go along with those things. So we want something. Say we have a sense of wanting or craving for something, then we'll automatically just try to move toward that and get the fulfillment and the gratification that results from that. Or if we dislike something, or something isn't so nice, or something is unpleasant, some sort of criticism, some sort of loss that we experience, some sort of pain that we experience, or a loss of status, loss of reputation, that's unpleasant. And so if we are trying to get away from those things, then the mind, the heart that's enmeshed in the world will automatically follow along with any moods connected with wanting to get away from those things. So for example, somebody criticizes us, or you could say even somebody annoys us, we get irritated and annoyed. This is just very common. This is a normal experience for everybody. And the heart that's enmeshed in the world will automatically follow along with that and try to get away from it. So there is this attraction, that default option, the automatic reaction to follow along with things or to be repelled by things and try to get away from things that are unpleasant. Follow along with the pleasant, get away from the unpleasant. So these are very normal. Say in the world, it's normal to speak your mind. If you feel like criticizing somebody, it's normal to criticize somebody. One time when Longpa Liam was here, he taught that when we feel dissatisfaction, it's normal to be critical. When we feel satisfaction, it's normal to praise. And so whether we're praising or criticizing can be an indicator of whether we're experiencing satisfaction or dissatisfaction. So those are just normal ways that the mind, the heart that's enmeshed in the world will go around and around and around. And it's a burden. It's a big burden that we're all carrying. This is a very big burden because when we have to follow these things, then they're dictating to us what we do, how we act, even how we think. And really, these things are all not self. We think the desires are ours, that they belong to us. We think the anger is ours, that it belongs to us. These are just causes and conditions. It comes from our conditioning, comes from our upbringing, comes from our past karma, even from past lives. If we subscribe fully to the Buddha's teachings, then these habits and tendencies come from past lives as well. So things like our perceptions, we might think our perceptions belong to us. We might think the sankharas belong to us, but they're really just causes and conditions of nature. And to step back and be able to see them as not self. So the worldly way of seeing things would be to just completely believe all of this, to completely buy into it. And then the Dhamma, the Buddha teaches mindfulness, which is another approach. And mindfulness is different than just following along with these things. Mindfulness is different than just having attraction and following it, having aversion and following it, being grabbing onto things and following, or trying to push things away automatically. So the mindfulness is what gets us to step back. And we can say that the mindfulness is actually a reminder to ourselves. We could call it remindfulness. We're reminding ourselves that, oh, we can step back from this. And then the sampajanya, the clear knowing or all-rounded awareness, clear awareness, is what we're reminding ourselves to do. So that's why we always combine sati sampajanya, because the sati is like the thought, the reminder that we're reminding ourselves there's a different way to relate to all of this. And then the sampajanya is just the knowing of it in the moment. And so that can say, when we say establishing mindfulness, that can really put the brakes on any sense of upset that we might have, or if we're really lost in following along with some sort of craving or some sort of really intense mood. That, and again, these things are normal. These things are normal that they arise, but then it's like, it's putting the brakes not on the mood. It's not going to stop the mood necessarily, but it's putting the brakes on the tendency to follow along with it. And then we'll be able to see it much more clearly. So then we have sati panya. So then that's the clear seeing, the discernment of what's going on. And then if we're able to do that, then what a relief, what a lack of burdens, that incredible lightness, just to not be burdened by those things and to not have to follow the dictates of the various cravings and obscurations in the mind and the heart. So the teaching of the Buddha about mindfulness, it's all about coolness and ease, cool, light, ease, relief, refreshed, about being refreshed. So we might start to experience that the mind has a sense of refreshment. It's feeling refreshed very often. And then we are able to appreciate the moment. We are able to step out of the stories in the mind, the issues that the mind is creating. And it's so interesting that all of our thoughts are invisible and they're just immaterial. They're things that are happening in the mind. And yet they have such an effect on our entire world. A single thought can lead to us suffering or happiness. So even though they're immaterial, they have a lot of power. They have a lot of power when we follow along with things, when we push things away. That gives power to these things. But with mindfulness, it takes the power away from the defilements, takes the power away from any sense of heaviness or craving or aversion. So when we see something like anger and we try to get rid of it, that really makes it more powerful. If we have something like craving and we try to stamp it down, deny it, destroy it, get rid of it, that gives it a lot of power. But if we see it with mindfulness and clear comprehension, then that really takes the power away from it. And, oh, it's nothing. It was just a story. It's nothing. It was just a thought. But that's difficult to do because it's like a barb that's embedded in the heart. It's like a multi-leveled barb that's embedded in the heart, and we can't just rip it out in one go. So it's difficult. It's difficult because these are habitual. These things are habitual. So it takes time. It takes time and a lot of investigation, a lot of practice, and everybody's going to be at a different place. And we might get into comparing ourselves. For us monastics, we might say, compare ourselves with other monks, other ajahns, or for the lay people, might compare yourself with others. But everybody's going to be at their own place in this path. The fact that everybody here is coming to listen to a talk, coming to practice, that's already good. It means we've developed a reflective capacity. So developing that reflective capacity is an extremely important step, just to be able to look at, oh, the mind is doing this, or the body is this way, the mind is this way. Just being able to do that is already big, because that's the beginning of not following along with the cravings and the aversions that are arising all the time in the mind. Then we'll have a lot more space to develop things like goodwill. We'll have a lot more space to develop things like reflections on impermanence and uncertainty. We'll have a lot more space to just be at ease, at least sometimes, and give that gift to ourselves to be at ease, and things won't be as heavy anymore. That's not to say there won't be times we're tested and difficulties. And the times that we're tested, if we are able to hold it in the way of Dhamma, then we'll see it as a good opportunity to practice, a good opportunity to be shown where we're at in the practice. Goodwill, goodwill for ourselves, goodwill for others. That's going to be a lot more easy to do with mindfulness when we are able to step back from the attractions and the aversions and the stories that the mind is creating. Then it's going to be much easier to just say, oh, right, well, what did the Buddha talk about cultivating? What did the Buddha say was wholesome thing to cultivate? Oh, having goodwill, that's metta, is well-wishing for oneself, well-wishing for others. Can I wish myself well and really mean it? Can I say the phrases of the metta chants and wish myself well, but then really mean it? And then we can reflect on, what does that mean? How do I actually do that? So reflecting on the teachings, that's Dhammavicaya. So with goodwill for oneself, and then the cultivation of reflecting on the Dhamma teachings, on the various teachings, and trying to gain insight and a penetration into their meaning, that is Dhammavicaya. And then we're on the path to reaching the wholesome, on the path to having more of a sense of coolness and ease in our lives. So I think I'll just offer that for reflection this evening. That's about good for the time allotted.